great job, do that again. And so when most of us sit down to meditate, we don't really know what's going on inside our minds or what we're supposed to be doing. So with Muse, we're able to solve that problem by giving you real-time feedback on your brain activity during your meditation.
We are recording. This is another episode of the Automate and Grow podcast. My guest today is Ariel Garten from Muse. She is the co-founder of a product that I actually use. Look. What do we think about this? What is this thing on my head, Ariel?
That's Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you meditate.
And the podcast episode's over. No.
Da-da-da-da.
Da-da-da-da. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm really excited you're here.
My pleasure. It's a joy to be here with you.
So we kind of gave away the punchline, but what is Muse?
So Muse is an awesome little device that gives you real-time feedback on your meditation. So we all know that meditation is good for you, but it can be really hard to do. There's no, you know, little person sitting inside your head saying like, hey, you did it right. Great job. Do that again. And so when most of us sit down to meditate, we don't really know what's going on inside our minds or what we're supposed to be doing. So with Muse, we're able to solve that problem by giving you real-time feedback on your brain activity during your meditation to let you know when you're in focused attention, let you know when your mind is wandering, and then to quantify it. Actually show you what your brain is doing and give track your progress to improve.
So I personally was introduced, I think I mentioned to you, to Muse by a friend, Sean O'Brien. Shout out to you in Florida.
Go Sean!
Yeah, Sean introduced me to something that was really interesting, which, you know, nobody knew that I actually meditated. And somehow I came up with a conversation with Sean. He was like, hey, do you have a Muse? And I think what's interesting about it is the gamification aspect and the fact that you're getting that feedback. So what have you found from people that have tried Muse? Like, is that part of the appeal?
Yeah. So for people who've never meditated before, Muse is the thing that kind of shows you what you're supposed to be doing. It demystifies it. It makes it not this weird, confusing, woo-woo thing. It's just like, this is what you're supposed to be doing. When your mind is here, you've got it. When your mind's not here, you're off it. This is how you get back to it. And then for somebody who has a long-term practice already, Muse becomes a new insight into your mind. It's kind of like when you hold up a mirror, all of a sudden you can see like, oh, my hair is a little funny here and I should like wipe the schmutz off my face. You know, it gives you a new set of insights into a process that you might have been familiar with but wasn't able to see from all these angles.
So did you start this because you were a meditator, or how did everything get going?
So my own background is in neuroscience. I was trained as a neuroscientist. I was also an artist and like to create experiences that help people understand their own selves. And I was training as a psychotherapist at the time. And so I started to work in the lab of this man, Dr. Steve Mann. He's actually one of the inventors of the wearable computer. And he had an early brain-computer interface system, a single electrode that you would put on your head. And by shifting your brain state, focusing or relaxing, we could make sound, translate your brain activity into sound, or translate your brain activity into making a light bulb get brighter. And I stood back and said, like, wow, we are literally interacting with the world directly with our brain, and people need to know about this. So I got together with the two amazing people that became my co-founders, Chris Ameny, who was an engineer and Steve's master's student, and Trevor Coleman, who was just amazing at business and product and knowing what people loved. And the three of us set about to figure out what we could do with this amazing technology. And ultimately, we recognized that as we were teaching people to focus and relax, to make a light bulb get brighter or create music, we were actually showing them what was going on in their mind when they were focused and relaxing. We were effectively teaching them to meditate. And that if we took this technology and applied it to truly teaching people to meditate, we could solve this fundamental problem of meditation, which is the ability to really understand what's going on inside the mind.
And I love
it. This was born.
Well, it harkens back to the original Ghostbusters, where someone's sitting there and they're getting biofeedback, right? But
yeah.
So is this, and I think you said you started the lab part in like 2003, right?
Yeah, so Steve and I and Chris were working in Steve's lab in 2002, 2003. And then we spent a long time trying to figure out what we're going to be. In 2009, we actually became a company. incorporated. And then we did some crazy explorations of what we do with the technology. And it wasn't until 2012 that we really honed in on the fact that we could make a meaningful tool for meditation. And we knew what we wanted to do. And at that point, meditation was so under the radar that we couldn't even tell anyone it was a meditation tool. We told people it was a cognitive trainer to like help your focus. You know, it's going to make your brain strong. And as meditation started to become more mainstream, we really were able to just be there at the moment of the zeitgeist and provide the tool that people were looking for at the time when people were trying to figure out how to meditate. So our first product came out in 2014. We've now then had Muse 2 come out, which gives you real-time feedback on your heart, your breath, and your body in addition to your brain. And we just released a new device, Muse S, that also helps you fall asleep.
Oh, that's really interesting, because I think that's a big one, right? Which is, I mean, for me anyway, as someone that is a really light sleeper. So what's the difference between, let's say, a Muse S that helps you fall asleep and the brain sensing headband? Like, is it the program itself or?
So a few differences. So we noticed that with Muse and Muse 2, people were meditating in the evening to help them fall asleep. So our most common times to meditate were 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. And when we started to examine the behavior, we recognized that they wanted to fall asleep with this device to help them sleep. So Muse S is actually a purpose-built headband that's soft. So it's a super soft, comfy headband that you can fall asleep in. You forget that it's there. And it comes with what we call guided sleep journeys. So they're these beautiful meditations that guide you into sleep, paired with a soundtrack that's actually built from your body, that's designed in a way to help you fall asleep faster. So you'll hear the soundtrack and you might hear the chirping of crickets, but that sound is actually the beating of your heart. So every chirp of the cricket is a beat of your own heart, or the lapping of waves that's created from your breath. And so as you start to fall asleep and relax, the soundtrack also shifts as your biosignals shift. So it's like actually adapting to you. And then it starts to entrain you to slow down even further in a way that's designed to help you rush yourself easily off to La La Land.
So if I understand this, what you're doing is you're mimicking, is it the brain itself or the heart rate?
So we have sensors for the brain, the breath, physical movement, and the heart. And so we've got the soundtrack from all the sensors.
Oh, got it. Okay, so you're taking all of that to create the soundtrack.
Yeah.
So what's the cricket? Is that one particular element, or is it kind
of like a... So there's lots of different soundtracks. So one of them is a nature soundtrack where you hear like the chirping of crickets. Oh, and it is literally every time your heart beats, you hear a cricket chirp. And so, you know, like you're sitting in the woods, there's the rustling of leaves, there's the gentle lapping water, and all of those sound elements are actually you biofeedback from your body.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
It's super cool.
So the Muse 1, I assume I have Muse 1, right?
Do you have a heart sensor on it?
I don't think so.
Yep, that's Muse 1.
Okay. So when I hear, for example, that's not on this one, it's only the new one? Is that a new feature or is it the same in this?
No. So the go-to-sleep journeys are specific to Muse S. With Muse 2, you also get experiences for your heart, your breath, and your body. So you can literally hear the beating of your heart like the beating of a drum. You can hear when your body shifts, so you can find stillness. With the original Muse experience, which is the one you have, and that's the core Muse experience is still the most popular one. With the original Muse experience, what you're hearing is the sound of your brain translated into guiding sounds. So the metaphor we use is your mind is like the weather. When you're in focused attention, you're in a meditation zone, you're going to hear it as quiet. And as your mind starts to wander, you're going to hear the storm pick up. So if you're in the rainforest, a rainforest soundscape, when you're in the rainforest and you're focused, it's very just like just pleasant little rain. When your mind wanders into the storm, the rain picks up and you hear it. And that's your cue to bring yourself back to focused attention.
Okay, that makes sense with what I'm experiencing then. Yes. I never really put it into words of actually how it was helping me in that sense, like the actual mechanical part. So thank you for that. It's awesome.
And it's we built it in such a way for it to be really intuitive. So you don't have to get caught up on like, what's my brain doing? It's just like, it's stormy. You inherently want to make it quiet again.
And it's very effective. Like for me, I never really intellectually thought about how you were doing that or why I was hearing these noises, but that's what's happening. So that's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's funny that, you know, I like your insight into the Muse S, because what I've probably been in the habit of, I'm guessing for 2 years maybe, is I'll tell Google or Alexa to play ocean sounds or forest sounds. Mm-hmm. And you kind of take it into another level where there's like this biofeedback part, right?
Yeah, where the ocean and the forest are adapting with you.
Very interesting. So, you know, it sounds like the base of this, and you'd mentioned Dr. Stephen Mann and the research into computer brain interfaces. And I think people don't understand, number one, what those are and what impact they're going to have, I think, over the next 10 years. So I guess as someone who's a pioneer in this space, is this a step to that? Is this, is Muse going to go beyond the meditation application?
So for us, we're really interested in human health and performance and how we help you understand what's going on in your body and your brain, and to use that information in some meaningful way. So the first step was teaching people to meditate, which is really one of the best ways to be able to, you know, query yourself, query your mind and body, understand what's going on, and then make a different set of choices, be able to make the kinds of decisions that help you live the life you want to live, not get caught up by all the stories in your own mind that hold you back. You know, be able to notice when you're really stressed and bring in the breathing exercise that you learn to calm yourself down, and to be able to choose the state of regulation that you're in. Sleep is the next step for us, because sleep is so fundamentally important. And with an EEG device, we actually have insights into your sleep that none of the other devices can have. EEG is the gold standard to understanding sleep. And once you have that, you can start to do interesting things like smart alarms, sleep tracking. There's a host of features that we're in the midst of building out. And then the next step after that is giving people more and more insights into what goes on in their brain and their body and how it can relate to different aspects of their health. So, you know, we're currently starting down the path of FDA to look at how this can be used with different clinical conditions. There's been over 200 research studies published with Muse already.
The
Mayo Clinic just published a study with breast cancer patients awaiting surgery, demonstrating that they improve their quality of life and decrease their stress and fatigue through the cancer care process with Muse. Mayo's doing 5 more studies. So there's a lot of different research directions that third parties have taken this in. And so, you know, we're there to support all of that research as well as building our core product.
So I think the one thing that was, I don't know how many people, I'm sure a lot of people saw it, was the interview that Elon Musk gave with Joe Rogan, and the, the most recent one, where they talked about Neuralink. And yeah. do you have much insight into that? And what's kind of your interest or feedback on Neuralink?
So Neuralink is, you know, fascinating. Whether it's going to be successful or not, we don't yet know. You know, this is how you decode the brain and do something meaningful as a result of it is something that researchers have worked on for a long time with only small gains. I definitely appreciate Musk's approach of let's get the smartest people in the world in working together. You know, I was watching all of his hiring and all the positions that were open. Oh, yeah.
The approach is what you would want, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's, some sense. Of them are the kinds of people on our team, like computational neuroscientists, EEG signal processing people. There's a lot of overlap. We are fundamentally focused in helping people optimize themselves through self-understanding. The act of trying to, you know, decode and read or write is super fascinating. Mm-hmm. Whether he'll succeed or not, I don't know. You know, there's been stuff that's been done that has been great demonstrations, but has never proved out practically. You know, me and my team literally spent years and years and years making like thought controlled toasters and thought controlled beer taps and controlling the lights on big buildings with people's brains. Like this is an area I've spent a lot of time in.
Right.
At that time, you know, this was, let's say, 2010. So at that time, the state of the art was you couldn't do much that was meaningful. Mm-hmm. It was really only very broad gestures based on shifts in state. Data science has moved ahead dramatically since then. And, you know, projects like the Connectome that are trying to map the human brain and the Connectome for the brain, there's a few different Connectomes, trying to map the human brain and really understand what's going on inside of the mind specifically on both a population level and an individual level have moved projects like Musk's significantly further. So, you know, time will tell. I think in a decade we'll see something interesting. I don't anticipate seeing something interesting in a year or two.
Right.
But it's one of those things where you put enough time and money and people onto it in a focused way and you will get somewhere.
So I think there's a few aspects of the conversation that I found really interesting. And just for people that are watching that don't know what it is, Neuralink is essentially a chip-based approach where they can put a chip on your brain physically. And then the idea is what they would map the electro connections in the brain. Mm-hmm. So they create like a model of how everything's firing.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, but then the next step is that that would somehow be the new interface to computers and AI. So he says, essentially, first off, AI is getting so smart, but it wants a conversation, but it doesn't want to talk to a tree and you're the tree. But what he says, the real problem, and you can tell me if you agree with this or not, is the interface, which is keyboards and voice are just too slow. And the bit rate between you and these faster and faster machines is just, there's a huge gap and it's getting bigger. So his idea, and maybe this is not what other people think, but is that this is the new interface as opposed to a keyboard or voice. Does that sound like is that kind of common in that area, or is that like what your understanding of it is?
Yeah, so he's presented this various ways. I didn't listen to the Joe Rogan podcast, so yeah. You gave an interpretation that I hadn't quite heard before. This is his updated talking points. It's really true that it is quite inefficient to be communicating through your fingers and then onto a keyboard. It's really inefficient. Until now, we have not had an efficient way to have direct brain-to-brain communication. We have not been able to map our brains effectively. Everybody's brain is different. We don't know. Moran, who you might have heard speak on Dreams a few weeks ago. Yeah, a friend of mine, Moran Cerf, he's an amazing neuroscientist, and he's credited for having discovered the Bart Simpson neuron.
So there's
an existing paradigm in which people do brain-computer interface, and that's with individuals who are undergoing epileptic surgery.
Right.
So they already have their skull opened, they have their cortex exposed, then you do electrocardiograms, so you put tiny little electrodes right over an area of their brain, and then you're able to very specifically stimulate and respond and listen to what happens. And these people are awake when it's happening. Your brain doesn't have any pain sensors, so you can put tiny microelectrodes in there and the person will be able to feel it. I mean, it does hurt when you open your skull, but that's another issue.
You know, whatever.
And so in his research, he was able to stimulate very, very specifically neurons, I'm guessing around the hippocampus, and when asked the person what came up for them. Since you grew up in Canada, you might remember the Wilder Penfield burnt toast.
Tell people what this is, because this is a very famous like heritage commercial in Canada.
Yes. Yep. So both Michael and I grew up in Canada, and the Canadian government must have paid a lot of money to have heritage moments played on the five stations that we could watch as children, because that's the only television we had. It's like seven stations.
The Maple Curtain.
Yeah. And, you know, before the hockey game, we're going to get really stereotypical here about Canadians, you would watch these commercials, which one was about basketball, because basketball was invented in Canada, and the other one was about Wilder Penfield, who was actually the first person to have been able to map the brain in any way. He was an epileptologist in the early 1900s, mid-1900s, really. And when he inserted an electrode into somebody's head in this commercial that we watched over and over again, the woman said, "It smells like burnt toast." And he had then discovered the area in the brain associated with the sensation of burnt toast for this woman, the specific encapsulation of that memory.
It related to her seizures, right?
Yes. So whenever she had a seizure, she would have the smell of burnt toast. You remember that commercial really well. Clearly, this like etched deeply into our minds.
It's like emblazoned in my brain. It's like, "Doctor, I smell burnt
toast." Burnt toast, yes. And she's like lying there.
You know what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to go on YouTube and I'm going to find it and I'm going to splice it into this episode. Anyways, it's a great description. It's like brings back memories for Canadians.
Yeah, nobody, totally. Nobody,
what the hell are you talking about? Okay, so the point being.
So, toast is burning.
Toast is not. Every time she has a seizure, she smells something burning. Now, if we can.
So this is a very, I'm just splicing this in, but this is what Ariel and I were talking about with the Canadian Heritage Moment. And this is Dr. Wilder Penfield. And we've, as Canadians, you grew up seeing this many, many, many thousands of times beyond comprehension how many times.
And provoke that smell by probing the surface of the brain. We'll find the source of the seizures. This is called, do you feel anything?
I see the most wonderful lights.
And now what do you feel?
Did you pour cold water on my hand, Dr. Penfield?
Now what? What is it, Mrs. Gold?
Burnt toast. Dr. Penfield, I can smell burnt toast. Dr. Wilder Penfield. He cured my seizures and hundreds more. They say he drew the roadmap of the human brain. We just called him the greatest Canadian alive.
Yeah, so that's the commercial we're referencing. Anyways, it's a great description. It's like brings back memories for Canadians.
Yeah, nobody, totally. Nobody,
what the hell are you talking about? Okay, so the point being.
The point being that this methodology of being able to stimulate specific areas of the brain and then elicit memory, sense memory experience from a person has been around for a while. And Moran did it in a dream and memory context. Oh. And he started stimulating areas of the brain, and in one person, he could reliably stimulate one neural connection, and the person would have a memory of Bart Simpson. And so, one of his claims to fame was identifying the Simpsons neuron.
Amazing.
For this individual, I mean, it's varies widely. You know, every person's brain is mapped a little bit differently.
More likely, everyone has a Rick and Morty neuron
these days. Yeah. So bringing it full circle back to the conversation that we've been having about Elon Musk, his concept of putting a microarray into the brain that can map to specific neurons is not crazy. It's been done since Wilder Penfield. The microarrays have gotten better and better, and part of his innovation is to make microarrays that are incredibly thin and incredibly precise so that you can, interact on the neural level. And then if you're able to stimulate and record the response, you can start to map what the neurons that your array is into associate with, and what thoughts, feelings, experience, parts of the brain they relate to. And then from there, you could potentially, so one of the questions is reading from the brain, being able to decode what's going on. Another question is writing to the brain. Can you then input information? So the brain is, your neurons can communicate electrochemically. So it's basically an electrical impulse that causes one neuron to fire, which fires the next neuron, which fires the next neuron. And the permanent firing of neurons together is what creates memories. So if you, and neural connections are very complex. So you might have hundreds of neurons coming together, and it's the precise timing of the firing within this group of neurons within a period of time that then generates the overall signal. It is very much like a computer.
Yeah.
And so the question is, if you can, reliably generate a stimulation to an area with specific pulses and firings, can you then encapsulate, encode, input data?
Right.
In the same way that we get data from our eyes, which is light bouncing to our retina, which is then goes through a lateral geniculate nucleus, which then sends data back to the area in the back of our head or visual cortex. And the precise way that the light impacts our eyes leads to a precise set of firings that then creates an image at some point in our head. So if you understood the relationship between all of those neural links, or you started to create your own relationships, could you use that as a different mode of input rather than just light firing to the eyes that then gets translated into impulses to make image? Could you directly stimulate the cortex, which would then get, translated to create other information, thoughts, feelings, etc.? This is where we get really spooky. Mm-hmm. And this is actually the part of it that I'm not into. You're not intellectually fascinated by? Totally, 100% intellectually fascinated by. But that I don't sort of subscribe or buy into as you know, as a person who loves people and the life that we live. And I'm very curious about human evolution. And I think the idea is fascinating, but I certainly have my own reservations. And from a technology perspective, it's not a place that I will ever go.
So I think what's spooky about it is, one, that, you know, our human experience is based on imperfection, and our brain is super imperfect in that we encode really bad memories sometimes.
Oh, for sure.
Right. And we have a system to bury them that we don't even understand as individuals. Right. Like, and we have, so it's almost like we have this supercomputer in our skull, but it's got like a really unreliable hard drive. Like, we can't pull out everything we should necessarily. Right. We have, you know, and you're working on this, which is your conscious and your unconscious, and there's stuff that's suppressed and buried and you forget. Because it's almost like you're saying, it's like you're trying to, what Musk is almost, or what you're saying the task would be is, what's the connection between this, this, and this that fires this? Mm-hmm. And we're like, I don't know. That's why people create mnemonic devices, going back to Socrates. Right? So it's interesting because we almost have random recall in a lot of ways. Like, we have expertise that we really hone in on, learn in this very long, slow, inefficient method of teaching each other and learning, right? But then it's like, you can't recall. And the promise maybe of why a guy like, you know, Elon Musk would want it is, I have perfect recall when I need it. So that's probably part of it, right?
It's not just recall, it's also processing power. I mean, you think about, humans are incredible supercomputers. You put a bunch of complex information into us, we can analyze that complex information, add some emotional drift to it, and come up with a solution, which, you know, is an imperfect solution because you have emotional drift in there. When you think about the idea of putting in information into the human supercomputer and then allowing that level of input to, you know, mix with the milieu of our own computational processes in our brain, and then out come new concepts, ideas, images, experiences, like, you know, the possibility is endless. Anybody who's ever taken a psychedelic drug knows that a tiny, tiny amount of an input is going to give you a vastly different experience, different kinds of cogitations, you know, different kinds of visuals, different kinds of sensations, to the point that we, you know, we make up these cool experiences that they have created for us. And they also sometimes do some rewiring along the way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, leave us permanently changed. So when you think about how this kind of computational input could dramatically both change the experience of self and the kinds of stuff that we can think of, you know, change the sort of outputs, ideas, problems we could solve, etc. Like, the possibilities are really endless. It is incredibly cool.
Yeah, but it's scary being rooted in this other human experience, probably. And that's to your point, like, you're not interested in that because there's probably what is human pops up.
Yeah. I mean,
you're an artistic person too, right? You're not just a scientist. So
yes,
you like, you like the splatter Jackson Pollock of our life, right?
Yes. So I'm definitely intellectually fascinated by it. Totally intellectually fascinated by it. You know, we're staying so firmly grounded into how can we give the person more information to query the self and make these internal processes visible and tangible and actionable so that you can uncover the cobwebs and make different choices and see more clearly and understand the emotional drift that's impacting your decision making, and undo the roots of trauma, because God, memories are screwed up.
Right. Totally. For everybody. Even if you don't really have, like, I think we're built for trauma. Right? Like,
oh, we totally are built for trauma. Yes. Like, I mean, our amygdala hyper tags everything that is traumatic. And then it just plays itself over so loudly.
Right? Like, non-traumatic is traumatic. In a sense, like, I think that's why algorithms on social media work.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're firing our dopamine response to negativity.
Yep.
Sometimes pleasure, but they say, like, what, 75, our brains are like 75%. Is it? I don't know if that's accurate, but 75% more wired for negative experiences to deal with those than positive.
Yes. I don't know what the actual stat is. I don't know how exactly. Well, I guess you arrive at the stat by, you know, having people's eyes drift to things that are negative or positive. You can totally do that experiment. So I don't know what the actual stat is, but yes, you know, as part of our own preservation, we are wired to look towards the negative.
Okay, so I want to be conscious of your time because I know we're probably bleeding and I could talk for 3 hours with you about this. I literally talked to Daryl Davis, by the way, for 2.5 hours, which was unplanned. Oh.
Amazing.
I also think that video is shadow banned. It absolutely was. Okay. Which is weird on YouTube. Thanks, YouTube. So I think the promise of what, you know, you're working on the same sort of problem, which is improving people's lives through feedback and uncovering the kind of those hidden things. This is like potentially the next evolution, which is what the Neuralink and other brain computer interfaces are. And I think all of us though would love to be like in the Matrix where we learn Kung Fu in 5 seconds.
I know Kung Fu.
So that's the promise, but whether we get there or not, I guess we'll find out. And the last quote that I keep hearing in my head is that we have Paleolithic emotions and godlike technology. So how do we bridge the two?
Oh, that's a good one.
And I don't know who said it, but it keeps every time I think about this, this is what rings in my head, which is like, well, why are you resisting these new things? Which is why music is great. And then I go, okay, well, what's my real limit eventually? If this is out there, would I do Neuralink?
I was just going to ask you that.
I think it boils down to if Elon does it and it works, because I think he's not going to do it unless it works. He's not going to just put it in his own brain as an experiment.
I think there's, you know, as humans, we are afraid of the unknown. And we're afraid, we're basically for self-preservation. And that's sure. Exactly what you just said. If it's not going to impact my self-preservation, if somebody else will do it and not die and not get permanently screwed up by it, then I'll do it too.
And someone as smart as Elon Musk. Because how much smarter would he be with this thing?
Extraordinarily.
Like exponentially?
If it works.
If it works. The way, and I don't think he's going to do it unless it's that. I don't think he's going to do it just for fun.
So who's going to test it first? Who's going to be the guy that tests it before Elon so Elon knows it works?
Well, what they're doing is, he says in the next 12 months, they're going to brain injury patients. And that's who, because they're already in trouble. Mm-hmm. So that's where the first, I'm assuming the next 5-10 years is. I'm guessing it's on people that have brainstem injuries, that have other trauma to the brain, whether it might be like extreme CTE, like you think of how, I don't know if that could help it. But that's the promise that he's shooting for. And I think those are probably acceptable risks because they're already needing brain surgery, right? So putting, and there's probably, like to your point, there's already stims that are probably going in there. So this is a very small leap for that audience. So I think that's where they'll learn if this is going to work or not.
Yeah, there's a system called BrainGate that was created by Lee Hawkins. And that's been used for the last 15 years. And it is an array that implants directly into the motor cortex of an individual who's quadriplegic or paraplegic, and it allows somebody to relearn moving a robotic arm.
Oh,
and it's
wow.
It's gotten quite complex. You know, people can grasp, can turn, they have like, you know, 10 or 15 degrees of freedom created by simply a direct neural implant.
That's amazing. So I think that's where it's going. So I think we'll figure out if it works based upon who's already a high risk or compromised audience, right? So I think that's probably where we'll figure out in the next 5-10 years, could this work on a healthy person?
I'm imagining the Elon Musk heritage commercial that, you know, our grandchildren will be watching many years from now as they watch the television directly plugged into their brain or whatever it is.
He went to Queens.
He's a Canadian too?
He's South African, but he's Canadian. He grew up in Canada.
Mm.
That's what people don't...
Yes, he is.
That's so strange. I said this to someone. I keep like, that guy's Canadian too. What the hell is going on? Like, there's a weird Canadian underground in all these really impactful areas in life. It's bizarre. But maybe because I'm looking for it. But
that and Celine Dion and Michael J. Fox.
Justin Bieber, Drake, Ryan Reynolds, Ryan Gosling, Rachel McAdams. Like, you start going through all these things that people love. Like, hey, do you like The Notebook? Like, yeah, they're both Canadian.
The Weeknd.
The Weeknd, right? Oh my God. Anyways, I don't want to go on that trip. I could probably do a whole episode just on that.
Cool Canadians you've never thought were Canadian.
Like, what? Alex Trebek? Okay, so I want to be conscious of your time, even though I haven't been. So we're going to wrap with a few things. First of all, thank you so much. I want to acknowledge the amazing work that you guys are doing and that you specifically are doing.
Thank you so much. Me and my team. I mean, it takes a lot of people to create a brain sensing headband that helps you meditate that actually looks and sounds cool.
It's mission accomplished so far. I'm excited to see what you guys got coming.
Thank you.
How do people get in touch with you?
So you can find Muse at choosemuse.com, and you can find me on Instagram at Ariel's Musings, Twitter Ariel.Garten, and on every channel at choosemuse.
Beautiful. Oh, do you freeze? No, you're back. I'll edit the little freezes out. Okay, a couple of quick things. One, if you are the sum of the five people you spend the most time with, who do you spend the most time with?
My son, who's 4 years old now.
Oh, cool.
So I already see the sum of him in me as I roll around the floor, wiggling like a worm and putting together Lego. My husband. This is a fascinating question. Had you asked me pre or post pandemic? Because right. These days we haven't left the house here in Canada for 3 months, and I've spent all of this time with three people, me, him, and my husband.
I love it. That's great. Anyone else, or you want to?
So then, of course, best friends and coworkers. So if I was the sum of those, I would be an intelligent and fascinating bunch that still wiggled on the floor and played with Lego.
I love it. Okay. How are you?
Oh, was that a theoretical question or an actual question?
It's however you interpret it. Because you know what's funny is some people have said they rattled off books and authors and video, and then other people are like you, like they're talking their actual connection. So I always meant like actual people, like who do you socialize with, right? But it's surprising some of the answers. Any dead people you hang out with, like authors or someone said something interesting, what was it? Jim Rohn. I'm like, he's dead. Yes, but.
And then there's also musicians, you know, right. The music you listen a lot to.
True.
Those are people voices that go through your mind over and over and over again.
Those are all very valid answers. So I don't judge the answer. I just like to hear them. How are you, Ariel, changing the world?
I'm helping people understand that the shit that goes on in your head doesn't need to hold you back. That the stories that you have of, I'm not good enough, I will never do that, these people don't like me, that all of those things are a byproduct of our upbringing and stories that no longer serve us. And that when you're able to examine them, tear them apart, and move them aside, you're able to live more effectively and more happily in your life. And when you're able to dismantle the tyranny of fear, because fear generated by the self more than the external situation creates this tyranny over us, that when you're able to dismantle the tyranny of fear, on the other side is always freedom and generosity.
I love it. That is a very, very exciting mission, frankly. I love it. That's amazing. The final thing is, when we have interesting people on the podcast, we like you to nominate other interesting people. We generally talk to experts or entrepreneurs. A lot of time I am trying to talk to people that about how they automated or grew a business, but it's definitely not limited to that. As a matter of fact, it's probably more often than not, we talk to authors and people with really interesting ideas. So who would you, Ariel, like to nominate as a future guest of Automate and Grow?
I will nominate Dr. Steve Mann.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Inventor the wearable computer, the guy that made Google Glass before Google did.
What? Okay, listen, you got to make this happen though, because I'll just be crushed if I don't get to meet him now.
I'll see what I can do.
Okay, so Dr. Steven Mann, the legendary Dr. Steven Mann, you've been nominated by Ariel as a future guest of Automate and Grow. We will accept that. We appreciate the introduction. Ariel, thank you again so much for your time, and I'm excited about what's coming with Muse.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to spend time with you today.
We will talk soon. This has been another episode of the Automate and Grow podcast. We will see you on a future episode of Automate and Grow.